Loading up?
Yeah. Great.
Very good. So, thank you.
Thanks, Linda. So I'm going to talk to you about some of the effects of transportation and trade globally on the environment as well as on public health. I have no financial relationships to disclose. And obviously this is a very broad topic, and I've sort of purposefully chosen to just focus on three subsets of that full topic to talk a bit about global shipping and ports and what in the transportation arena goes by the jargon of goods movement. And then I will talk a bit about exports and manufacturing, specifically addressing some issues in China and occupational health. And I'll end by talking a bit about how we in this country recycle some of our electronic waste, all those little goodies that we're carrying around in our pockets. So the map here really demonstrates the routes of global shipping around the world, where the blue indicates a relatively low level of shipping activity, and the red indicates a higher level. So for once, those are not political parties. And you will see that most of the global shipping around the world occurs between North America and Asia, and between North America and Europe. And over 90% of the goods, the products, the consumables that are produced are transported at one point or another by the almost 100,000 ocean-going vessels. Ships actually burn the dirtiest fuel on the market, and it's at a room temperature state. This fuel is actually a solid. Ships, as you'll see in just a moment, produce major amounts of carbon dioxide emissions that contribute to both climate change as well as ocean acidification. And you might ask, well, even if this is an issue in terms of the environment, why should we as public health practitioners or researchers care about that? Just one small fact to indicate that is that the particulate matter emissions from shipping alone accounts for about 60,000 cardiopulmonary lung cancer deaths each year. If this chart demonstrates emissions in terms of CO2 from different countries, and you will see that the sixth point on this chart is representative of a global shipping fleet. If global shipping were a country, it would be the sixth largest producer of carbon dioxide emissions. It's responsible for about 3% of the total CO2 emissions in the world. Global shipping is also a source of what is called black carbon, or commonly known as soot, which is really just the particulate matter from incomplete combustion of a carbon fuel source. And if you look really just at the cartoons, you would see that in a normal setting in the Arctic, for example, the polar ice serves to reflect back most of the sun's light and energy into the atmosphere. As that ocean heats up, some of that polar ice cap melts, meaning that more of that energy is absorbed by the ocean, in turn increasing the ocean's temperature and exacerbating that melting situation. In addition, the deposition of black carbon from shipping acts to reduce the reflectivity of that polar ice cap, again leading to more absorption of the light and energy from the sun, less reflection of that light and energy, and again leading to a faster melt of polar ice. And in part, this is responsible for the fact that the Arctic is the fastest warming area of the world. Global shipping is also a major threat to the oceans around the world. As I've just demonstrated, it's a significant source of carbon dioxide. If we were to try to compare this to emissions from cars, for example, which we seem very focused on trying to address, and if you looked at all of the greenhouse gas emissions from global shipping, it would be the equivalent of over 200 million cars. 2 years ago, there were about 130 million cars registered in the U.S., so this is more than 50% of the emissions produced from vehicles that are represented by global shipping. In addition, global shipping contributes to both warming and increasing acidity in the ocean. That increasing acidification has effects on coral reefs now that are already occurring, as well as on marine organisms that depend on carbon for their internal and external shells, which leads to changes in the marine food webs. As I've just shown you, that there's also effects on increasing sea levels, and a number of the more direct effects on human health relate to increasing distributions of harmful algal blooms, of vectors that are responsible for waterborne disease, of weather patterns, which we've seen some examples of recently, and also to the methods of food production. If we try to look more directly at some of the community impacts in this country, this chart demonstrates, in this case, nitric oxide emissions from large ships in the orange bars. And again, it compares that to the number of cars in millions that would equate to a similar degree of emission. If we focus on Los Angeles, for example, we will see that there are about 10,000 tons of nitric oxide that occur just in the port of Los Angeles and Long Beach, and that is the equivalent of about 11 million cars annually. Most of these communities are very densely populated. Ports tend to be densely populated regions, not only in the U.S. but around the world, and they are impacted by this air quality effect. So if we focus more specifically on Los Angeles and Long Beach, that one port accounts for more than 40% of all U.S. imports. Those ports contribute more than 20% of all of the region that we happen to be in now, particulate pollution, and it really represents the single largest source of pollution in this area. And that is responsible for more than 1 million respiratory-related school absences, more than 60,000 cases of asthma symptoms, and 2,400 premature heart-related deaths per year. So there are efforts underway to try to address this problem in Los Angeles and Long Beach. The state, as well as the industry, has developed a clean action plan a couple of years ago, which is aimed at reducing air pollution by 45% within 5 years, and also reducing the truck emissions by 80% in that time frame. Obviously, these ships have to offload their cargo onto something, and in most cases it is trucks or railways. They are also implementing a what's called a container fee to fund the replacement of about 20,000 trucks to meet tighter EPA diesel fuel standards. And the California Air Resources Board has established what it calls a cold ironing program, which is shown in these two photos below, which is requiring ships to plug into electricity rather than run on their diesel engines when they're docked in port. So this just shows one of these locations of a battery generator, the crane that's hoisting it up to the ship, and this is that generator on board the ship. Basically, the ship just plugs in and uses this battery generator instead of running its engines on diesel fuel constantly while it sits in port. In terms of broader effects, just like we could slow down our automobiles somewhat, simply reducing speed of shipping by 10% would reduce emissions by almost 25%. Switching to a marine diesel oil would reduce carbon dioxide emissions by 5% and particulate matter by more than 60%. And there are also some operational and technology implementations that could be put into effect. Different routing and planning could reduce emissions. In terms of technology, improved hull designs, special coatings can reduce the resistance of the ships. And as you may have seen some examples of, in some cases, some ships are using more SITE or kite-assisted propulsion, and obviously this is just taking advantage of wind, which is zero emissions. So let me shift a bit and talk about China and exports and imports. This is a graph that demonstrates the rate of growth and exports from China to the U.S. over the past 10 years. And you can see that that's really quadrupled over that time frame. And it applies to most everything that we utilize in this country, from computers and their parts, to apparel and household items, to furniture and to toys. And you could similarly ask on this end, who or what is it that imports to the United States? And this is not really intended to be a diatribe against one particular company, because you'll see that that company is also taking some steps to try to address this. But in effect, if Walmart itself were a separate nation, it would rank as China's fifth largest export market ahead of Germany and Britain. And what I wanted to just try to tell you a bit about are the occupational health effects of this export production in China. You know, in this country, we've been very worried, rightfully so, about the products that we import from countries such as China. And we just need to realize that there are very severe health effects due to this production and this manufacturing economy in China as well. So the reality is that if you were simply to compare the occupational health and safety regulations in China versus the U.S., you would see that China has actually pretty effective limits on workplace exposures to hazardous substances. In a lot of cases, these are actually better, lower exposure limits than they are here in the U.S. But the problem is really in terms of enforcement and implementation of those regulations. And so that leads to really huge numbers of occupational disorders and mortality. And these are numbers that are really from the Chinese Ministry of Health, and so you can take that with whatever grain of salt you choose as to how representative they are. But 3 years ago, the Chinese Ministry of Health reported that almost 400,000 Chinese workers died of occupational illnesses, and that almost 30% of the labor force, more than 200 million people, were routinely exposed to toxic chemicals. And so, for example, this means levels of benzene that are greater than 10 times the allowable level. So in addition to those real occupational health effects, we should also be aware that this export economy in China has effect on our environment and as part of this climate change process as well. So just last month was reported really the first publication to try to subdivide CO2 production from China into the different elements responsible for that emission. So if you just focus on the blue bar, which is exports, you will see that it has grown from about 12% of CO2 emissions by China a decade ago to 33% of Chinese CO2 emissions now. Government production, households, and capital, which is mostly the domestic manufacturing productivity, have not grown at the similar rate as has the export production of CO2. And this is a trend that is really driven by consumption in developed countries such as the U.S. So an important factor to be aware of just in terms of policy considerations about how we deal with climate change is what's referred to as carbon leakage, meaning who is really responsible for this increasing CO2 production that takes place in China. What are the right policies to try to deal with that? What are the associated costs and benefits of those policies? So there are some efforts underway to try to deal with both the occupational as well as the environmental outcomes of the exports from China. So Walmart, and this is really just this month in October of 2008, has reached an agreement to try to require manufacturers to allow outside audits of the factories and manufacturing facilities such that they will adhere to social and environmental criteria. To have stricter ethical and environmental standards, to ban child and forced labor and at least pay the local minimum wage. And by 2012, over the next 4 years, most all of the production from factories that are involved with Walmart importing here should be receiving the highest ratings of audits on environmental and social practices. But again, this is not meant to be focused on just one company. This is obviously one of the larger importers of Chinese goods. But the reality is that most American businesses that import from China are really just small and medium size, and they don't have the wherewithal to try to visit or audit Chinese factories. So we are very dependent really upon China to implement and enforce its own occupational and environmental safety standards. And that is really where the crux of this problem resides. There's only one trade union, for example, in China, and it is controlled by the central government. and there's only one safety inspector per 35,000 workers. And so these two photos really just demonstrate work at a steel mill, and most of these places are located along the coast where the exports can take place. And this is actually the dormitory. This is the living arrangements at that steel mill. So one other effect to be aware of is that this really leads to hundreds of thousands of in-country migrations within China from the central rural regions to these coasts where people live and work in this kind of environment. So lastly, let me just say a bit about how we recycle waste in this country. You know, most of us are really totally dependent on computers and cell phones and televisions and all of the associated gizmos that go with them. Very little of that is actually recycled in this country. Most of it ends up in a landfill. More than 80% of the electronic waste we produce is exported to the developing world. It is the most rapidly growing segment of municipal waste globally, and it obviously contains a large variety of toxic compounds. So any given computer or television monitor, for example, contains 5 pounds of lead, one. And I'm going to tell you just, or show you really just two places where this type of recycling has become very predominant and some of the effects associated with that. So one is in Lagos, Nigeria. It is Africa's largest port. The amount of electronic recycling that takes place in Lagos is equivalent to 400,000 computers or monitors or television sets per month. There is really no systematic means of dealing with this. This is what happens to it. So it is basically just put into a landfill where there are no regulations, and most of it ends up being burned. Well, I don't really need an internet server. But and then the other example is in Guiyu, China, where more than 70% of families are engaged in this type of recycling of electronic waste. It's done in a very hands-on, primitive technique, if you want to call it a technique, really. So, for example, this just demonstrates a woman who is baking a circuit board to try to recover the platinum and the other heavy metals that do have some value from those types of materials. And if you just a recent study last year, for example, examined blood lead levels in the children in this community, and they found that the mean blood lead level was 15 micrograms per deciliter, which I'm sure you're aware is more than it's 50% more actually than the CDC standard fraction in this country. And if you were to compare that to an adjacent community in China that it does not carry out this type of electronic recycling, where most of the industry is actually textile manufacturing, you would see that not that it's good, but that about 40% of children in that control community had elevated blood lead levels compared to 82% of the children in this community where most of this electronic recycling takes place. So again, what is it that can be done to try to address this kind of problem? And actually the global community has come together to try to deal with recycling of electronic waste. Almost a decade ago, there was a policy put into place referred to as the Basel Convention, which is intended to require developed countries to inform undeveloped countries when they are importing hazardous materials, including electronic waste. Unfortunately, there are only 3 countries that have not ratified that pact. And even given that policy is in place for most of the world, there are still major problems with that. For example, some of the companies exporting these materials to less developed countries, as well as some of the companies on the receiving end, are able to label these products as educational materials, not electronic waste or not hazardous waste. And so simply changing that labeling means that this policy does not apply, and it also significantly reduces the shipping cost, allowing more of this to take place. In this country, some states have taken it upon themselves to enact laws to enhance the design, the manufacture of these products, as well as to try to put into place some control over their recycling. And in the private sector as well, I would say a number of the manufacturers, especially for computer products, have taken it upon themselves to try to reduce that waste stream and establish some recycling programs. So I'll end there, which puts us almost on time. And I thank you for your attention and for your extra time. Thank you.
And if anybody does have any questions that they want to ask of any of the presenters, they'll be up here. And I'd like to thank you all for staying and hope that you enjoyed the session. Thanks.